The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Lachlan Bloom.
And me, Jamie Batchin.
For those of you listening to this podcast for the first time, it's part of a series where we talk to fellow writers about their approach and technique.
So this is the April 2022 episode, which ties in nicely with our guest who has a book out this month. And this month's guest is Sarah Bourne, who is the author of Spill, Simmer, Falter, Wither, A Line Made by Walking, Handiwork, and Seven Steeples, which will be either in shops or imminently to be in shops as you listen to this episode.
Yeah, and Sarah's also a visual artist, and we talked a bit about how she manages the two practices of visual art and writing, and how they overlap and intertwine, and the differences between the two.
Yeah, it was really interesting to hear how the two practices sort of inform each other or give her the ability to move her mind in a different direction if she needs it, if she needs to switch from one to the other. She's got a great Instagram account which sort of charts her visual artwork, which we'll put the details of underneath this episode. It's well worth checking out.
Yeah, without any further ado, we give you Sarah Bourne.
We often just start with asking you what typical writing day looks like, although this often reveals that there is no such thing as a typical writing day.
It's a good question, and I'm always kind of shocked and reassured, I suppose, to find that most people don't have much of a writing day. I think I must have heard an interview with Jeffrey Archer early in my life, in which Jeffrey Archer, you know, does sort of 12 hours from 6 to 6. Okay, maybe not that extreme, but he definitely puts in a lot of hours. And that stuck in my head, and I just always felt terrible for not doing that. But at the moment, and I mean, I'm probably the worst of all. At the moment, I'm doing a studio residency because I work also as an artist. So I'm literally not writing at all. I'm just going into the studio, and I am doing bits sort of on the weekends, but I don't bring the computer in, because you bring the computer in and then half the day is done answering emails. And so, but I tried to fool myself that there is merit in that. Working with my hands for a period of time and switching off from language or written language is perhaps nourishing in some other way. Or maybe I'm just making excuses.
Do you find it quite easy to make that split between writing and your work as an artist, or, you know, between writing and anything else that isn't writing? Do you find it's sort of natural to slip into writing hours, and then when those hours end, your mind is free from writing and you're focusing on other things?
I don't know anyone who's really, and this is a really sweeping statement actually, but generally I think people who are making interesting art have something else that balances that out, you know. And it doesn't have to be another art form. For me, it's working with my hands, but, you know, my partner loves fishing. Lots of people, it's music, you know. And I think that I really think that that's important. I think that there are more and more writers now that kind of come from that twisty route, that they come from a different background and switch over, and they kind of bring this baggage from the real world or from a different world into the writing. And you kind of find a different way of looking at it. I didn't write anything until I'd been going to the cinema, to art house movies for years. When I was in art school, I used to go to the IFI, which is kind of art house cinema in Dublin. And I'd go to maybe 2 films at the weekend. I'd no social life, so it was all my money went on the cinema at the weekends. I wasn't discerning about it at all. You know, I'd just go to what was on. But I think I learned so much about narrative from that, and about scene setting, I suppose. All of those visuals going in. And I hardly ever go to the cinema now, but, you know, it's kind of different now. It's easier to see films without leaving your house. Yeah, so I think I constantly feel bad that I'm not a real writer, and I'm not just reading and writing all the time. And then I think, no, if I did that, I'd be a completely different writer, and maybe I'd have no writing in me at all, you know, that somehow perhaps the guilt of not doing it as fully as I should is what generates material or makes me write anything at all.
Do you feel that the two, you approach your preoccupations in both art forms? So I believe you're doing some stuff with ships and things at the moment, as per your Instagram. So is that the sort of art side? But do you find that you're addressing the same sort of preoccupations, maybe in quite abstract and unusual ways, in the writing and the art, or are they quite siloed?
Well, it's funny because I don't know that I write issue-driven novels. Well, I mean, no, I suppose it's fair to say that everything I make, whether it be a piece of writing or a piece of art, is kind of generated by my anxieties about life and about the world that we live in, or it's telling a story about that. With the writing, it's less immediate. So I suppose Seven Steeples is very much about the world sort of disappearing and being left, and these two people sort of being left. I mean, initially this couple decide to sort of step out of the ordinary world in a way, and to live alone on this hill and to cut themselves off from ordinary lives and from their friends and from their family. And then it's funny because then that sort of happens in a way with the pandemics and the lockdown. And so in a way I don't know that it's subconscious or anything like that, but now it's funny when I think about it, I see a sort of nuclear war scenario, you know, where you literally do just shut yourself in the house because nature is contaminated and you can't go out. It's kind of, for me, a way of working out my anxieties around certain topics by making something that is, and often fiction is a more effective way of doing it. And when I don't have any language at all to even articulate it, then I make things. So the ships that I'm making at the moment are container ships, and they have little sails on them, which is a way of looking to the future, because in actuality, I think the Chinese and the Swedish people are developing container ships that are powered by sails, by wind, as opposed to by oil. And I think that's probably something that's going to become a serious concern now. And it was also like we lived in the, I won't go on about this because it's quite a long story, but basically we lived in a harbor for years and we would see all of these ships coming in all the time. And I just found it overwhelming to think about the amount of stuff that comes in. You know, every colored box on a container ship has the, you know, probably tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of colored boxes inside. And then all the stuff that went inside them still. And that's what the world is being driven by. And that's become so much more worrying and so much more pertinent just in the last 2 weeks. That all that, but I didn't have an essay about that or a novel. So I just started making things, making these ships, and something about the number of them accumulating, the amount of kind of hours and care that have gone into their making, communicate my strength of feeling about it, you know, or my confusion. Sorry, this is the last thing I'll say about the ships. But when we lived in the harbor, there was this one particular container ship that came in every week at the same time. And someone said to me once, and this is true, that it was the banana boat, and it brought all the bananas from South America and it brought them into Ireland. And then inside of that boat, there were all the bananas that we would eat in Ireland for an entire week. And this just seems so logical and yet so mind-blowing, you know. And I can never even look at a banana now without thinking, the boat.
So with the artistic side of things, and I hope you don't mind speaking about this as well, I know it's primarily a literature podcast, but do you have, obviously with a novel or a project like that, you sort of sit down and you go through drafts and you have an idea about what an ending will look like for it. Do you have the same thing with the ships that you're making? Do you have an idea that you're going to do it for a certain amount of time? You want to achieve a certain number of iterations of a boat, or is it more free form than that?
Yeah, well, I mean, with both a novel and say the ships will be an installation at the end, so really just quite a small installation. There'll be like maybe 50, maybe 100, and it will be a single piece. And so that, I guess that's what I'm aiming for, but obviously things change as you go along. You know, you think you're going to have, you know, you think they're going to be bigger, or perhaps that they're going to be smaller, or that they're going to be, I don't know how they'll be positioned. You know, I might hang them from the wall. I might, you know, build a floor for them or build some kind of a setting around them. And it's exactly the same with the novel. You know, when you think about it, you set out with, okay, this is going to be roughly a 200 page novel, and there's going to be 10 chapters or whatever. And then as it goes on, you know, it totally changes, and, not totally changes, but it changes subtly for various different reasons, you know, and you incorporate the concerns that come up while you're doing it. So yeah, I mean, they're all similar. I remember learning in art school, and it's always stuck with me because it's come back to me as a lesson. I mean, I did a master's in creative writing that was about 9 months, and so I have done that route, but but I'm kind of, I'm always in denial. I like the idea of myself as just sort of ordained by, you know, by the art gods, and not as someone. I like the idea of myself as an outsider and not someone who's gone through the institutions, but I have in fact gone through the institutions. So I remember learning that when you're making a piece of sculpture, everything about it should have a meaning in itself. So for example, don't paint it red unless, just because you like the color red, paint it red because, you know, because it has some intrinsic relevance to the to the meaning of whatever the thing you're making is. Perhaps a better example is I made a piece about vagrant birds, and I made it in out of cross stitch because it seemed right to me that something about birds, which are these sort of delicate little buoyant creatures, should that the material should be something that's soft and light. And that, to me, that's come back to me in writing, in the sense that when you create a character, you have to know everything about the character, you know, the heart of the character, the family of the character, the inner life of the character. Even if none of that goes on the page, no more than the meaning of the color red might be stamped on the sculpture, that those things are kind of there, that's what make a piece of work authentic.
I mean, thinking of the parallels between the art work and the novel, there are obvious parallels there, but I guess differences in those sort of choices around texture and material are not there in a novel, not in the same way. When you're writing a novel, you've got 26 letters and some punctuation marks, and that's your lot. You can't really extend beyond that too far, whereas, you know, you can use any materials at all in creating an artwork. I'd imagine there are limits as well in what you can achieve, but the scope of material is a lot bigger. Having said that, there are different approaches to forming the text. Do you find when you're writing, it's a case of sort of experimentation? You're trying different styles, forms with the words until you find the right thing, or do you kind of start and get a draft down and then go back to sort of edit?
I would never, ever, ever start with like, okay, I'm going to write an experimental novel and, you know, it's going to, I'm trying to be stream of consciousness, say, because unless it suits, it needs to, you know, the idea for whatever it is I want to write is what's there first, and the story, I suppose. And then the form finds it, you know, you find a form based on what is completely right for the meaning of the material and what enhances its telling in some way.
Once you have the idea of what it's about, are you sort of creating various different versions of a scene or of a character's voice and then comparing them, or are you sort of writing a longer piece and then going back to pick out the bits that work or the bits that don't work?
I'll tell you how I wrote Seven Steeples. And it's funny because I remember reading an interview with Mike McCormack, and he was talking about writing Solar Bones, and he said this a few times in different interviews, that he had no memory of writing it, you know, taken literally, or like, how can you have no? And he was like, well, you know, he had no memory of, he had memories of editing it and the various different stages. And I remember hearing him say this and thinking, that's a bit bonkers. And I guess at that time when he was promoting Solar Bones, that would have been pre me even starting this novel. And I kind of forgotten about it for years, because I started this around 2017 and I wrote it more slowly than you can imagine, through me slowly. And then eventually when it was done, I had exactly the same feeling. I don't really remember writing this. Like, I know that I know I started it with like notes. I had little post-it notes. And initially I was interested in this road that I would walk every morning there and back again with the dogs. And over the course of about a year of walking it, I remember thinking, God, how much it changes and yet how little, you know, that the details of it over the course of a year were just, because our seasons are so severe here. And I thought, I'll make some kind of an account of this. And initially I thought, I wonder, could I write an entire novel just about one road and how much it changed, or how little it changed? Now, obviously it kind of expanded out from that to be a bit about a few more other things. But so initially I would go for that walk in the mornings, and not even every morning, but every couple of mornings I would come back with maybe just a word or two in my head, an observation, and I would write a word or two on the post-it as soon as I came in, because then I'd go and have breakfast and get dressed and this kind of things. And sometimes I'd have forgotten them. So I had to make a few words. And then I guess I would sit down at the desk for a few hours in the morning and actually, you know, expand on whatever it had been and get a few sentences out of it. And then, so I kind of remember doing that. And then the book was kind of written and I remember editing it. But I don't ever remember a period when I was, I don't know, again, I see what Mike means. You know, of course I do remember writing it to some degree, but I can't ever remember it being like a day job, sitting down and, oh, I must work on my novel today. It just came together very easily. And at the same time that I was writing it, or I'd started it, and then I wrote Handiwork, which was my nonfiction book that was published in 2020, that was written sort of in between at the same time as this one was sort of half being written. So I guess the two kind of got blurred together. And now I don't really remember writing either of them at all.
Can you see joins between them?
Yeah, absolutely. Seven Steeples is the novel. And then Handiwork is the little book that fell out of it. And I can already see, like, my publicist, my Irish publicist, was saying something about a scene in Seven Steeples. And I had to correct him. I was like, oh, actually, that was in Handiwork. But I think that's okay. You know, I think if people have read them both and then time passes, the details will get mixed up, you know. And that's completely fair. You know, they're both largely true. It's just that one is, like with fiction, you think, I can make a more interesting version of this in fiction. And my novels are always true stories sort of stretched to their extreme, you know. So Mark, my partner, and me moved to the countryside, but we didn't actually like delete all of our family's names from our emails, you know. So it's kind of like the truth is a much softer version of what's in the novel.
Did you work, you were saying you started with the post-it notes and then would write it up. I'm guessing that was writing up in the computer, in software somehow. Did you have one giant document that everything was going into and then Handiwork sort of at some point split out from that document and became a separate document? Or did you start a new document with Handiwork and there was one main Seven Steeples document? Or did you have 20 different documents that at some point became the draft of Seven Steeples and separately became a draft of Handiwork?
I honestly can't remember. I'd say I had separate documents. I can't remember it, to be honest. I don't think it was ever one. I think I always knew that there was, that Seven Steeples was a novel. And I had the title from quite early on. But then there were parts of it that didn't seem to fit with the rest. And I was trying to tell this story about, it seemed, you know, the way things seemed so important at the time and so like connected. I made this connection between working with your hands, between handicraft, essentially, and between bird migration. And I was like, oh, at first I thought it was an essay that had spun off from writing the novel. And then I realized that it was quite long. And during that, I think I read The White Book by Han Kang. And it dawned on me that this was only about 10,000 words. I was like, 10,000 words can be a book? And I've always had a great relationship with Sarah and Lisa and Tramp Press in Dublin, who are my indie press, that have published all of my books so far. And I thought, ooh, they might maybe just let me get away with this. And they did, which worked. So yeah, so at the time, I mean, I could have, you know, Handiwork could have been shorter and it could have been longer in a way. You know, I've kind of written essays since that are a part of it. Yeah, so it's a funny little project. It seemed to work okay, but it's definitely related to this novel enormously, such that that was another mistake. Someone or quite a few people had made the assumption that the two characters in Seven Steeples are artists. And I mean, there's no details of anything that they do. There's no, you know, they don't appear to have jobs. They don't do anything except for the kind of basic essentials of life. Which was the intention. I just wanted to pair two people back to, you know, their walks and their food and their shopping and the things that kind of that we all have in common, but that aren't the big things at all.
Well, that's the previous sort of vibe from your work beforehand, that people just get, yeah, sort of locked into the assumption that this is an artist's point of view, whatever happens. So they attribute that sort of background to your characters, no matter how much you just tried to pair them back and not give them that.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? Like, that's something that happens, I suppose, once you have a few books out. No one will ever read it as freshly as they read the first one. There's always going to be the baggage of the previous couple of years or, you know, all the podcasts you've done or whatever.
Do you find you struggle more to sort of pair things back or to add detail in? I mean, there's a sort of constant tension I find writing between wanting to put information in and then feeling you've given too much information and then wanting to hold stuff back and create a bit of ambiguity or mystery. I mean, how do you deal with that? Do you find yourself erring on one side more than the other more commonly, or is that tension that you find difficult to deal with?
I think like most people, probably I write a bit more and then I pair it back a lot. But like the more years that I've been writing, it's probably easier to write spare or quicker, if you know what I mean. Like with the first book, there would have been loads of stuff that got cut out. But now with the fourth one, I think, especially with Seven Steeples, because I just had a clear sense of what was there and what was important, and it just got put down the way it was in a way. And I have this weird, like, I'm almost sort of well, I mean, there's a touch of that in the book, sort of superstitious, as in, I think if something doesn't come quite easily and make sense straight away, then it shouldn't be there, you know. I've never labored over a novel for years. Now, I have been working on this one for years, but literally I was sort of working on it the sentence a day almost, you know, so slowly. Whereas I've never had, you know, I maybe had one thing that I wrote about 30,000 words of, and it just didn't, I still didn't like it, didn't make sense to me. And I just discarded it. But in general, I feel like if it's not, if it doesn't make sense pretty quickly, then it's just going to get, you know, you keep stretching it out and stretching it out and it gets more confused. So I'm kind of cutthroat about that.
So I'm interested in the novel that you discarded after 30,000 words and whether you repurposed anything from that or whether you think it's an idea you might come back to, but you have to completely start from scratch.
I don't think I'll ever go back to it because I don't know where it is, to be honest. Things, the computer crashed.
But the idea must still be in your head.
No, it's not. I've completely forgotten it. I think it was kind of more plotted than anything I've written before. And this felt like a deceit, you know, this felt like not me. I hate to start talking about motor vehicles because I warned you of this in an email. My head this week has just been like circling around. We had a van that broke down and so we're trying to buy a new van, but I don't know anything about motor vehicles, car brands. So it's all extremely boring and you're kind of trying to learn as you go along. So that's been my kind of thought process. And the comparison I was going to make there was about, you know, when you go, like we went to see this one vehicle and it was like an SUV, you know, which I don't even know what an SUV is. Is it a van? Is it a Jeep? It seemed to me just like a fat car, a really fat car. And we thought that this would be a good thing because it was higher up, it had better clearance. And it was newer. And it just feel like me and my partner sat in and we were like, oh no, it's not right. You just kind of know when something is right for you and when it isn't, you know? And I guess it's the same with artworks. And sometimes there's absolutely no way of explaining why. It might have been a perfectly good novel that someone else had written, but it just didn't feel like something that I had written. It felt like me trying to write a novel. It was like too self-consciously a novel. And so I don't think I can write things unless they sort of just fall out of my life as is.
That sort of feeling of it being right and fitting in with what's going on around you. Because you mentioned the walk you did that was a sort of impetus for novel and also the idea of sort of disappearance. Is that more sort of, I mean, obviously the walk is something quite concrete that you're physically doing it every day. You're getting up, your body is walking through the street. Whereas the idea of disappearance is something fairly abstract and conceptual. Is that sort of abstract layer something that you find is more in retrospect? Once you've finished it, you look back and say, oh yeah, this was all I was over that period concerned about disappearance, but it's not something that you're consciously aware of when you're writing. Or does that come first? Do you think, oh, disappearance is what this next novel is going to be about, and then you start looking around the world and noticing, you know, things on the street that have disappeared, and think, oh, I'll take a post-it note of that disappeared. That might be useful for my novel about disappearance.
It's a really good question because I did know, and I mean, I'm kind of giving away what happens at the end. This is something that I suspect I'm going to find really problematic in talking with Seven Steeples, because the end is really important and everything in the book gathers toward that end. And I knew pretty much from earlier on that that's what would happen. But then how do I talk about it without talking about what happens at the end? we'll just stick with disappearance because it's a good kind of slightly oblique way of saying it.
The sort of conceptual impetus for a novel versus the more corporeal, the real events and instances that you see and that create ideas for scenes or events in the novel. How do those two balance up?
Well, I suspect now, thinking about it, that knowing what happened at the end kind of did inform what was happening as I went, what was happening as I wrote it, you know, what I was picking up on and what I wasn't picking up on. So yeah, the sort of idea of disappearance that, like I say, that something that was really the hardest thing about the novel was getting sort of building up to the end and sort of setting these little clues. I mean, it's probably fair to say that the two characters who exist at the beginning become more and more similar as it goes along. And I mean, and I don't even know if these are things that people notice, but what I wanted was for, at the beginning, they're Belle and Cy, and then later they become he and she, and then eventually they're just they, everything is just they. And so that was kind of so subtle that it was tricky, you know, and then so that was on my mind going all the way through it. And then the other thing that was really hard to achieve was that the really only a year's worth of seasons occur during the book, but it's set over the course of 7 years. So again, did anyone even notice that? But I had every chapter was about sort of 2 months. So I wanted to capture the whole year, but the same time for the 7 years to elapse, because, you know, there's this thing about the 7 year that the body renews itself every 7 years completely, that you're like, you have a whole new skin or whatever it is. But then also there's the 7 year itch in relationships, that after 7 years, it's a bit make or break. You either marry them or you leave them. So it seemed like a good time frame. It's my most allegorical novel, and I really did want it to be full of these kind of symbols. And for me, I'm very interested in my artwork, and this is a way in which they're very connected, I suppose, with rituals and these little kind of observances that we invent for ourselves in the course of daily life. And for a lot of people of my generation anyway, and maybe especially Irish people, in the absence of religion, because I was brought up Roman Catholic, and then, you know, I got to be a teenager and I got a little disillusioned, and now I don't practice any faith, but I feel like I do and I don't. I practice all of these little sort of secular faiths in my daily life, and I wanted to kind of tap into that. I don't know whether anyone saw this either, but there's quite a lot of kind of religious symbolism going through the book.
Oh, I'm not sure I'm getting the book.
No, but it's getting you. You're almost not recognizable now.
Thank you.
This book is over.
I have a related question then, because there are things that get noticed and that are observed throughout as sort of each year comes along. There seem to be similar things that we sort of check in on as we go through each year and just take note of. Did you have any kind of notes that you were checking against that you remembered to sort of go back and look at that, or that you remembered something about the improvised washing line, as it were, and things like that? Or did you just have it in your mind? You had such a visual version of it that you were able to carry on through without having to sort of recalibrate it each time and check against things?
That wasn't completely straightforward, because, you know, they were sort of true and not true. So some of them were happening there in front of my eyes, and then others were, I'd be like, oh yeah, that thing, I better mention that again. That was one of my worries, I suppose, when it comes to like reviews and stuff. There's a lot of repetition in it, and it is very conscious repetition. You know, I wanted to repeat things because that's life. You know, it repeats itself. Every year you have to renew the payment for the bins or whatever the case may be. But I'm kind of worried that that will be trying, or that that will be criticized. It's that kind of fine line that we probably all have to deal with, is between like, will the readers know that I intended this, or will they just think that I'm being clumsy? So yeah, there were lots, but I mean, also they were sort of happening around me. Like, the book takes place over 7 years, but I guess it's funny, because when I started it, I had been with my partner 7 years, and I thought, I know I can write 7 years of a relationship. I know what changes and, you know, what is established or what falls away or whatever. And like, now it's been 11 years. So possibly there were other details that I realized later. There's still things that I think, oh, that should have gone in Seven Steeples, and I've missed it now. But with a book that's so boring, there's also this like careful balance of, I knew it couldn't be long because so little happens. You can only keep a reader with you for a certain amount of time when nothing's happening. And that's also the reason for the short sections, because I think everyone finds a book easier to read if nothing is happening and it's boring, if they have sort of snippets. So there's always the potential. There's always the hope that in the next snippet, something will happen. So you keep going.
Yeah, there's quite a psychology to that with books. Yeah, particularly even, I mean, with the more experimental end of things as well, I think just having a bit of, even if it's unbroken text, maybe having some sections just to stop. It's not really, not about it being boring as such, but just for the sort of pace that you're reading through it. I think that's, I find it quite important to have if I had like an 800 page book with no paragraph breaks or section breaks whatsoever, I think I'd find that just intimidating in itself, no matter what the writing was like.
I can't. I have like, I have a totally catastrophic imagination. So I'm usually expecting the world will end. And at the moment, as you can imagine, I'm really expecting the world will end. So there are a few books that I'll name no names, but one that came in recently, and I just opened it, and you can see that it's probably brilliant, but that it's going to take a certain level of commitment in order to get to the end and reap those rewards. And at the moment it was like, if there's a nuclear bomb by the end of the week, I can't. There's another pandemic, I'll read it.
That's what 2022 is gearing up to, isn't it? Are you writing notes at the moment for another book project, or are you focusing on the ships and the artwork at the moment?
I've just done two months of a residency in, and it's the first time I've had a proper studio space, and I found it really, really, no, terrible is not the word. I found it really hard, and it's funny how it's like the faraway hills are always greener thing. Do you know, it's, I mean, maybe all writers feel this and you can tell me yourselves, but do you know the way when you're not writing, you just want to like, you want to sit and write because you have these things going on and you're like trying to organize life and fighting for this time to sit down at your desk and write. And then as soon as I sit down at the desk and write, I think I'm just fidgeting, you know, I just want to go out. I'll just do anything else apart from write. It's like you romanticize it. In my head, it's wonderful, but I have the same relationship. So now that I've been just working with my hands, I kind of feel my brain needs to get back to work and I need to write things. So I'm really looking forward to writing again and to being back at the desk and going to the desk in the morning as opposed to into the studio. But I don't think I'll have another, I have no book. I have two essays that need to get done, but not a book project.
You mentioned you were sort of writing post-it notes. Is that something that's sort of ongoing in the background? Have you got a sort of pile of post-it notes that have built up somewhere that you've not got a book project as such, but there are a bunch of notes waiting to go? Or do you only get into that sort of headspace once you've got the idea of a book? I've got the ending. I know what this book's going to be about roughly. Now I'm going to buy a post-it note pack and start taking post-it notes.
I mean, there's lots of different post-its of different shapes and sizes, and they kind of have different, most of them are extremely boring, like, you know, there are people that you have to email, practical things. I had one yesterday that I was going to the vet and it literally said like anal glands, ticks, wormer, vaccinations, needles. So yeah, but it's funny, I keep them all. And then I have other ones that are full of like, you know, what is a VAT invoice and 2013, you know, number plates of cars and client reference numbers for insurers. I mean, I think like we all do, but I think they all kind of have their role. And like I say, I keep them all. I have a drawer here and there's no system, but I just bung all the post-its in the drawer. And I think, you know, maybe one day there's kind of an installation in them.
Is there any categorization? Like, do you have all the sort of admin life post-it notes on red post-it notes and all the novel related notes on yellow ones and artwork installation related on green? Or
I have a certain system in that if the small ones are like less important things, and then the larger ones are like, you know, my general list of things to do in a day. And then on the back, there's like, you know, like if you're downloading photographs and you want to remember the number, like really, really throwaway things. So I guess I have a system in that sense. It just occurred to me, though, that drawer is probably my autobiography.
Can I ask if there's any differentiation between the notes for installations or artwork or notes for novel ideas to write? And when you're taking the note, I imagine sometimes you think I'm in the middle of writing this novel, write a note about what this character says, and it's obvious it's a note for the novel. But when it's more general concept, you know, like ships that you're working on, the artwork, I could imagine a lot of the notes around ships in general as a concept could equally apply to something you're writing in a novel. Do you split those post-it notes late at all, or when you come back to them, do you sometimes think, oh, that was an idea I had for an installation, but now I read it back 2 weeks later, this has got legs as part of a novel?
Yeah, I think that hasn't really happened yet, but I feel like it probably could. I find it easier to maybe write, I end up sort of writing essays around the period of time that I was making a particular installation. I mean, that's kind of the only significant thing I wrote last year, and it was an essay about the lockdowns, I suppose, but also about making this installation of little, like I made these little souvenirs of my house. So, you know, the kind of, it's like an Irish cottage souvenir. I'm sure there's an English equivalent and it's a cottage or one of those Shakespearean sort of style houses or something, but they're just like little figurines of an Irish cottage. And so I was making these little effigies of my house in that style. And I guess I was making them first, but then the writing grew out of that. And then sometimes you kind of, you fall off a cliff where you realize that whatever your essay you're trying to write is actually would be more interesting as a piece of fiction. And that's more often how I come up with fiction. You know, my last novel, A Line Made by Walking, similarly started as a piece of nonfiction, an essay, and then became more interesting if it was full of lies, you know?
And so do you see there's is quite a blurred boundary, really? Because you were saying something before we started recording about how you might retract this now on record, but you're perfectly happy for people to think that it's autobiographical to a large extent, and you don't like writers who say that it's completely made up. Do you think there's quite a large bleed between the fiction and non-fiction realms?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think that there's a large bleed, but there's also this sort of interesting culture. And I see this in artwork as well. Like, I'm actually having conversations at the moment with a painter for me to write an essay for a catalogue of his work, or for a book about his work, really. It's not so clinical as a catalogue. We're trying to do something interesting, but there's so much kind of, I suppose, you know, sort of pretending that you're not in your book, or you're not, you know, a vibrant part of your book, or that, you know, your life is actually quite different to what it is in the book. And I know this is often the case, but I don't know why we're not allowed to have this kind of bleed and to embrace it more, you know, instead of having these sort of sterile conversations that pretend that, you know, I'm actually have a great imagination and, you know, read lots of interesting things and, you know, did lots of interesting exercises and came up with this, you know, perfectly interesting, critically acclaimed piece of fiction. You know, it's kind of not the case at all. I'm writing the story of my life, because when I'm gone, there'll be some kind of a record. And sometimes, because my life is not that interesting, I can make a more interesting account of my life by, you know, bringing in untruths and sort of stretching the truth a bit or bending it. And so yeah. And I mean, sorry, where it was relevant to the painting, I suppose, is that there's, you know, it's like you're sort of expected to have an academic conversation about painting and the history of painting. Whereas in fact, people are really just, like I say, telling the story of their life, taking the details and the kind of rituals that are important to them, and trying to make a record of that, you know, in a way that seems truer than a perfect representation, you know, that sort of involves the gesture or the glow or the feeling of something as well. So yeah, so no, I'm always happy to say, I mean, there's lots of untruths in my novels, like especially the first one, I suppose. And the second one was based on a period of my life, but based on a period of my life I couldn't remember that well by the time I wrote it. And so there was lots of lies. And then this one as well, it became, everything is so neat in Seven Steeples. You know, it happens in these sort of circles. And there's these kind of fantastical little elements, like these eyes that keep opening up in the landscape and in nature. And, you know, obviously all of those are becoming sort of hyper-real or surreal or whatever. But you know, but I'm not ashamed of saying it's essentially true. Like if you came to my house, you would find a biscuit tin letterbox and, you know, and a garden gate that as described, and a tree with a slit in it, you know.
I'm not sure where it comes from for people to so desperately defend that their fiction is entirely made up, because I think the most interesting stuff is happening when people are playing with that anyway, but also by the sort of creative choices that you're making, and not just in writing and art and in anything else, in sort of visual art, you're surely giving away a lot about yourself by the things you choose to include, the things you don't choose to include. There's very fertile ground kind of playing with the boundaries.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, in that your choices will always convey something about you. The things that we notice and that, like you say, that we choose to include or we choose not to include. Something that seems completely, you know, science fiction, you know, can have more truth in it sometimes than, you know, what appears to be auto fiction. It depends how you write it, I think, sometimes, the spirit that it's written in.
It's interesting as well, the sort of frame in which people approach fiction in general, and the idea that the line between what's real and what's not real, or what's truth and lies, is should be an important part of the question. I mean, it's an important part of how you understand it, but if you're approaching a novel as a kind of factual account of things, and if I go to this GPS location, I'll find a gate exactly described like this with these dimensions and so on, that's just fundamentally the wrong way to read fiction for me. And yet a lot of people seem to approach it broadly with that sort of mindset of, like, well, we need to disentangle the true facts, the gates that are real, from the things that are not, the eyes and the landscape. But actually, it's the totality of the whole thing that is the truth. And that's, I mean, I think a lot of the way, never mind writing fiction, just the way we live, we're constantly creating these stories, and they're a mix of truth and lies, or act of fiction, whichever way you want to do it. But that the our reality is a mix of both. So for me, capturing that mix is what is good in a novel, not so much having certain real parts and putting some lies on top of it to make it look good, like a bow on top. If it works well, it's because the mix is a true mix that matches the mix in our experience, our lives.
Yeah, and I mean, we change our minds all the time as well, you know, and the things around us change. Your perspective on things changes and you kind of borrow from things and don't even remember that you've borrowed from them. I don't know, it's so... It's also hard to determine what is good and what isn't. It's funny, when you were talking there, I was thinking about, because I mentioned films towards the start of the conversation, and how actually a lot of what I gravitate towards watching now is like documentaries and docuseries and things that are actually true. And I wonder, has that changed, you know, the way I perceive or the way I approach making things, the way I approach writing? It's probably changed for a lot of people because with things like Netflix, you know, there's so much more easy availability, you know, there's so much more choice. You don't just go and see whatever happens to be the matinee in the cinema that weekend. You can pick out of any kind of a pool of things. And maybe that's changed how I perceive. I mean, the things I read, I've read way more nonfiction in recent years than I ever would have done beforehand.
Maybe that's the a reaction to all of the big real stuff going on in the world that sort of leads us towards nonfiction a bit more. Because I feel like my reading diet is drawing in. I don't know if it's just getting older anyway, but yeah, certainly. We've got so much to deal with that we want to try and find some of the answers. It's weird that we think we find that in nonfiction a bit more, or I'm finding that as I get older, I think that nonfiction is the place to go for that.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that's the logical way of thinking, but not necessarily so. I mean, I also, it's funny, it's like everything. I go through a phase working with my hands and then I just want to write. I'll go through a long phase of reading like short nonfiction books about, you know, in the spirit of Rebecca Solnit by women of my own age, which has been a trend for a while. And then suddenly I'll just be like, no, I really want to read like a huge Cormac McCarthy novel or something like that, you know, that there's kind of a balance all the time in the same way that you know, you crave salt and for a while and then you crave sugar or whatever the dietary equivalent is, that I'll definitely reach sort of breaking point with a certain type of book and then I'll go back to another one for a while and then vice versa.
That's interesting, that thing about the craving, because you said about the novel that you discarded because it just didn't feel right for you. It just wasn't you. It just wasn't right for the time, or it felt like you trying to write trying to write a novel, as you put it. But I think I get the same thing with reading, and it can be with short books as well that you should be able to just roll through in like, you know, 3 days. I just get sometimes, yeah, that clash. You feel like this is just not the right time for this. It doesn't sit with me right. Like, and it's something often quite intangible. The subject matter might be fine, the style might be fine, but yeah, just sort of feel like, nah, it's not for now.
Well, that's it. It's something intangible inside you. It can be, but it can also be world events, the time. Like at the moment, I find I can't watch like anything lighthearted or comedic on Netflix in the evenings. It seems kind of like disrespectful or something to the situation that's going on in Europe. It's kind of like, how can I watch Peep Show or The Office when there's a war going on, you know, in Europe? So it is influenced as well by the world. And you probably find that a lot of people are feeling that way. And so those reading trends as well. I think that's interesting. It's funny, something else that one of my bugbears is kind of about, you know, we all try so hard to be original, but in fact, originality is kind of, it's perhaps less interesting sometimes than when people are kind of doing the same thing all at the same time without realizing it. Now, not exactly the same thing, but, you know, you see sort of trends in, like my fear is always that, you know, your book is about to be published and then you find someone else has published an extremely similar book. But in fact, that should be fascinating because two people came up with the same book at the same moment in time, possibly in different countries from different family units, you know, whatever the case may be. And I think it's happened, or maybe I've just paid more attention to it in recent years. But instead of worrying about originality, you know, we should think there's something interesting going on and more relevant to literary historians of the future. If we embrace whatever is most concern to us at the time, and whether other people are doing that as well, that shouldn't matter. You know, that should be the point in a way.
Okay, and thank you to Sarah for joining us, and thank you for listening. As I said before, we'll put all the details about Sarah and her work under this episode. Go and check that out. If you'd like to know more about the podcast, we're at unsoundmethods.co.uk is the website, and at unsoundmethods on Twitter. If you're interested in me and my writing, it's jamiebatchin.com is the website, at jamiebatchin on Twitter and at jamie_batchin on Instagram.
And you can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com, where I'm Lachlan Bloom on Twitter. Do remember to like and subscribe wherever you find this podcast. Thanks again for listening. See you next time.